I got this blog and I set up an RSS syndication feed, which means that you can subscribe to it through an RSS aggregator on your computer. But I was having some trouble yesterday because I was trying to also syndicate the RSS feed from the cgames.com podcast, which is also a blog, onto my blog so that you could see both feeds on the same page. And the problem was that the RSS feed that was on there was looking to the wrong FTP server, so the XML link was bad. Who here understood what I just said? Two people, and that was exactly what I was expecting. Okay? And what I'm going to be talking about today is something called the curse of knowledge. Okay? Believe it or not, knowledge is a curse, or it can be. Number one, it can make us proud, right? Knowledge puffeth up, is what the Bible says. But the other thing that knowledge does as speakers is it makes it difficult for us to communicate. And the way that it does that is when we have knowledge, it's difficult for us to understand that other people don't have that knowledge. And so when we speak to them, we speak in terms and abstractions that make perfect sense to us but have no meaning for our listeners. Okay? So when I talk about an RSS aggregator, only a few people know what that means. And if you know what that means, it opens up a whole world of meaning in your mind. But if you don't know what that means, you start to fall asleep. And I was looking at some of y'all's expressions. You're like, oh, no. Because this guy is talking about stuff I totally don't understand. And I don't blame you. I wouldn't have understood what I just said until my blog broke yesterday. And I had to fix it. And I was asking Google help. And I had a friend come over and he fixed it. So the talk that I'm giving is based off of two books. One is Presentation Zen, which came out about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it is amazing. It's the guy is Japanese, and so he mentions Zen. It's not very Buddhist, despite the name, but he has some really great principles on simple and effective communication. And the other one is another Japanese guy, Language and Thought and Action, and that is what this talk is about, in part, is the Ladder of Abstraction. This book is worth 2 points. Because it is so useful. Who here has read Language and Thought in Action? Charity Chambers. Okay, looks like I need to put more points on that book. Just kidding. Okay, so most speeches are boring, right? Who here has seen a boring speech? Who here has seen a boring speech today? No, nobody raised your hands. Okay, most speeches are boring, and why is that? Why? Wait, sorry. What makes speeches boring? The person that presents it. Okay, more specifically, how does that person make it boring? Yes. Okay, monotone voice. Yes.
Too fast.
Someone's heard my talk before. Very good. Yes.
I think they stop a lot.
Yes, they pause. So there's lots of things about the way that we speak that can make it boring, but there's also a lot about what we say that makes it boring, and it can make the speech unclear. You see, even if what I was saying earlier in that example was interesting, and I was saying it in a good way, because what I was saying was unclear, it was boring. So, I bet you're asking, what is the ladder of abstraction? Who here was at my talk last year? Okay, so several of y'all are. There's new stuff, so it's not going to be all the same, but some of it is the same. And one of the people that's the same is Bessie the Cow, our good friend Bessie the Cow. And she is the key to understanding the ladder of abstraction. Because you see, Bessie here, our good friend, is not any cow. This particular cow is Bessie. Okay? So separated from all the other cows is Bessie, the very specific individual cow. Now, the word cow is a little more generic. It's a little more abstract. It doesn't just include Bessie. It also includes all of the other cows that are in existence. And so that word has different meaning. And remember, we're talking about words here and making words make sense. Because if words don't make sense, we don't make sense. And if we don't make sense, we are boring, right? So to explain the ladder of abstraction, I've got a slide here. And at the bottom, we have Bessie. And then one level up is cow, which includes Bessie and the other cows. And then livestock, which also includes Horton the pig and all the other pigs. And then we have up above that farm asset, which not only includes the livestock, but also the tractors and the shovel and the elbow grease that the farmer puts in. Well, it's not really an asset. And then you go up and then you have asset, which not only includes the stuff on the farm, but also the stuff in his bank and the stuff that he's in the real estate that he owns. And then finally, money. Okay? So Bessie down here at the bottom is money in a kind of abstract way, okay? But and y'all laugh about this, but so often when we talk, we tend to be way up here, and when we're saying up here, we're saying money and we're thinking Bessie, but we're not saying Bessie, and so they're not understanding. Okay, so one of the things I want to warn you is to stay away from dead-level abstracting. And this is a picture. I actually had to squeeze this in to fit this on the slide. This guy's way farther below that thing than even the picture shows. He's somehow working on a spaceship. I got the photo from NASA. So dead-level abstracting is very bad. Who here can tell me what it is? Yes?
Is it something like what Plato does in the Republic?
No. I don't think. Yes?
It's not moving up and down the ladder of abstraction.
Exactly. It's not moving up and down the ladder of abstraction. Dead-level abstracting takes two forms. One is people who get stuck in the details, okay? And who gets stuck in the details? Team policy speakers or Lincoln Douglas speakers? Team policy. Oh, we love those details. I have 6 pieces of evidence in 4 minutes. And by golly, you're going to hear each one of those pieces of evidence in the first minute and a half. So we try to cram in all the details. And a lot of you have read science textbooks that cram in all the details. And what happens when you cuddle up at night with your science textbook?
That
you have a great sleep. Some of my best naps were inspired by science textbooks. And the thing is, and I remember taking science, and what I needed, all I needed to grasp science, and for biology, I got this. I was like, how is this important big picture? How does this information connect with everything else that I'm learning? How does it apply to my life? I need some big picture. And with biology, they said, you're going to get sick, and you need to know what's going on in your body when you get sick. And I was like, okay. And I understood that. So then I took chemistry. And my chemistry professor, I was like, how do I need this? And he's like, well, you're going to need it to get into college. Well, I went to a college that didn't need it. So I didn't learn it. I didn't get that big picture that I so desperately needed. And your judges need that big picture if you want them to vote for you. Now, the other temptation is to get caught up in the clouds. So who does this? Team policy people or Lincoln Douglas people?
The other one.
Lincoln Douglas. Judge, I'm here today to talk to you about justice. I'm not exactly sure what justice is or exactly what comprises justice, but it is very valuable. In fact, I value justice. And so we have very abstract, very vague, very unclear. And so what you'll have is you'll have two Lincoln Douglas debaters, and they're talking with these very abstract terms. And at the end of the round, the judge has no idea what they were saying. And so they vote for the person that they like the best or how they talk the best. And it ends up being all about persuasive speaking. And that's why Lincoln Douglas people, it's all about being persuasive because the judges don't understand what you're saying half the time. So if they can understand you, if they could understand you, they would vote for you a lot more. Does that make sense? Also, learning how to go up and down the ladder of abstraction can also be helpful in car games. Who's played 20 questions? Okay? Who's played 20 questions and you're not able to figure it out, even after 40 questions? Okay? If you're doing dead-level abstracting, you are never going to win 20 questions. All right, is it an animal, vegetable, or a mineral? Well, it's an animal. Is it a cow? No. Okay? Is it a bear? No. Is it a you see how you could do that all day long? You're out of 20 questions. But if you understood the ladder of abstraction, you can win 20 questions in far less. My mom once got the wax on top of the king of spades in her drawer back in her room within 20 questions. Because her family is very competitive at this game. And they have little machines. You can get a computer that you can think of something, and it will ask you 20 questions, and you'll answer yes or no, and it will figure out what you're thinking. People are like, oh, it's magic. No, it's not. It's the ladder of abstraction. Ah! I'm on the wrong slide. Okay, it's this thing. Okay? The ladder of abstraction is very helpful. Not only that, but if you're ever using a filing system, it uses the same thing. What is this on the ladder of abstraction? You've got really big, a whole filing cabinet, say, to finances. And then you've got one drawer, and in that drawer is your family finances. So you say you have your business finances lower than that. And then in that drawer, you've got your budgets. And then in your budgets folder, you've got your January budget. And then in your January budget on that page is your budget for January for food. Do you see how that's very specific and part of a big, more abstract system? I'm getting blank stares. Okay. accounting. So, how... That was the ladder of abstraction. Since a lot of you have heard that, I gave my 30-minute speech in about 5-10 minutes. So now we're going to focus more on using the ladder of abstraction. So we didn't get to that much last time. And so the ladder of abstraction can help you win rounds. It also can help you communicate better. And the goal is to make your arguments sticky. If your judge cannot remember your 1AC when he's casting his ballot, you lose. Unless he can't remember the other team even worse. So the goal is to get them sticky. And to illustrate this, I'm going to give you two messages on the same idea, and you can tell me which one is more sticky. Our mission is to become the international leader in the space industry through maximum team-centered innovation and strategically targeted aerospace initiatives. Ah! Or, I have no mouse. So that's the first one. Second one, or our mission is to put a man on the moon and return him safely by the end of the decade. Okay? Second one. And that was from John F. Kennedy. He said those words, and the nation was like, yes, beat the Russians. And so we put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and we brought him back. A lot of men died in the process, but by golly, we got it done. Okay? And what was it was sticky. It stuck in the minds of Americans. It rallied us to a common purpose, and we got something done. So I'm going to give you quickly some principles from Presentation Zen. And I actually even stole the slides because I didn't have a lot of time to prepare. So even these graphics and stuff are from Presentations In. So one of the keys to a sticky argument is to keep it simple. Okay? There was a reason that Jesus' talks in the wilderness were repeated and repeated and repeated to the edges of the earth. Because he kept his message simple. And we take it for granted how simple Christ's message is. Can you imagine someone who contains all knowledge communicating to us? Could you imagine how complex what he said could have been? Have you heard a college professor talk? College professor doesn't have a fraction of the knowledge that Jesus has, but he's so complex in what he says. Sometimes you're like, I think that was good, or I might have disagreed with it. I don't know. But Jesus was talking about very abstract concepts. And how did he talk about an abstract? Let's take the kingdom of heaven. Very abstract. How did Jesus talk about the kingdom of heaven?
Analogies.
Simple, simple language. The kingdom of heaven is like a pearl of great price that a man found and he sold all that he had so that he could buy that pearl. Very, very simple. Another thing that helps make our arguments sticky is if they're unexpected. Okay, who of y'all expected me to start talking about computer programming languages at the beginning of this talk? Christopher Levinson. Way to go, bro. Okay, sometimes what you need to do is unexpected, and Jesus did a lot of unexpected things. He would be talking, and then he would get interrupted, and he'd have a great soundbite right off of that. So someone he's talking, and then someone's like, is it lawful to pay taxes? Oh, everyone's like, what is he going to say? Jesus said, what did he say? Do you remember? Render unto Caesar's only that which is Caesar's.
Give me a coin.
He said, give me a coin. Right. So it was so simple. I'd venture to guess many of us don't have much of the Bible memorized. Some of us have done and want us to know more. But that was so simple, so concrete, so unexpected that we remember. And if we can speak in those little proverbial turns, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It's those simple things, those unexpected things that are sticky. Another thing that's helpful is to make it concrete. Jesus spoke in very concrete language. He talked a lot about farms, farmers, shepherds, sheep, small coins,
fig trees,
things that we all interact with, things that are concrete. He didn't use big words. The theologians have taken Jesus' simple language and added big words to it, like epistemology. Well, actually, epistemology isn't theologians, but you anyway, I'm not going to go into those big words, but Jesus didn't need those because he was so smart. He was so cool. By golly, he could talk about a coin and make it profound. Another thing is credible. People won't listen to you much if they don't believe what you're saying, but I'm going to say something, and I want you all to hear what I'm saying. Statistics do not make you credible. Statistics do not make you credible. Team policy people, you too. Statistics do not make you credible, okay? You can use statistics, but what makes you credible is the contextualization of those statistics. And let me explain what I mean by that. It was a big, big word. If I'd have had more time to think, I'd have thought of a simpler word for that. Steve Jobs, in his keynote, and I encourage you all to watch him because he's one of the best presenters in the more modern form with using slides. The traditional form, I think the best presenter or speaker is Alan Keyes. If you can find a recording of him, he is great. And the styles are very different. And in speech and debate, we kind of have a balance in between. He was presenting statistics. At the beginning of his most recent keynote, he's talking about market share. And instead of listing off our market share was 26% and all this different stuff, he compared his market share to other people's market share and made it very, very real, very credible of here's our market share, here's where it was, and he told a story around that. He gave it contextualization. Here's a better example. You can say 66 grams of fat, and then you can give all these facts about a 66 grams of fat and how fattening that is. Or you can say 66 grams of fat, that's the equivalent of 3 Big Macs. Suddenly, oh, that can stick in my brain. 3 Big Macs. Man, that's a lot of fat. Okay? And that is what you need to do for your judges. You don't just cite statistics. If you cite a big number, break it down. Judge, the affirmative team's plan is going to cost us $300 billion. Judge, that's almost $1 billion a day. That's more, that's three times the number of dollars we have people in the United States every single day. You see how suddenly that means something? Because billion, million, trillion, when it comes to government spending, it's all the same, right? It's all a lot. But if you can bring it home and make it real, then you become credible. Being able to quote the statistic doesn't make you credible. Okay. Next is emotion. Okay? What I've learned in my marketing classes is that Americans, we think that we're rational beings. And we think that we buy products for rational reasons. And marketers are really good at getting you to think that you're buying their product rationally, when really, you're not. Okay? And this is also true of sharing the gospel. I can think of only one person I know that came to Christ because he looked at the facts and the stats and he was compelled by the evidence that Jesus Christ was true, that the Bible's true, that the gospel is true. And this guy is an engineer, and he's very effective, very wealthy engineer, or very, he's very much an engineer. The rest of us are not engineers, most of us, okay? And most people do not make decisions based off of facts and reason. They make their decision first on their emotions, and then they come up with the reason to back up their decision. And those of you who have judged, this is what happens subconsciously. You're like, man, I liked him. Why did I like them? And you come up with reasons, and it all happens at the same time. And so it's very important to learn how to appeal to emotion. And the best way of doing that is to... So let's say you're talking about the devastation of Katrina, or you're talking about a war. So let's say you're debating foreign policy. Katrina? Okay. The hurricane. The hurricane Katrina. Okay. I was like, wait a minute. Okay, so let's say you're talking about Katrina, or you're talking about the war, or you're talking about immigration, okay? You could share a lot of facts about how bad immigration is or how poorly immigrants are treated, or you could tell a story. You could tell a story of a family that came over and because they were starving, and it was a choice between dying or coming over the border. And they came over the border, and they had some children here who were U.S. citizens, and then the immigration services came, took the parents, thrust them into Mexico, and took the children and put them into foster care and destroyed that family. Okay, do you see how much more impactful that is than a bunch of statistics and a bunch of numbers? You could talk about Katrina, you could talk about millions of people's homes being displaced, or you could tell a story of one person that you know who had to flee from their lives from the water. Okay, connecting emotionally is so much more effective than just giving facts. And the best way to go up and down the ladder of abstraction, it's natural, it's sticky, and it's memorable, is to tell stories. Jesus did this all the time. He told very simple stories. And God did this in the Bible. So he's got all these things that he wants to teach us. Okay, he's got this whole book of 66 little books. What does he spend the entire first book doing? He told a story. There's hardly any preaching in Genesis. And then you get into Exodus, and the whole first part is a story. And then around Exodus 20, God's like, okay, now I'm going to tell you how to live. And what he was doing was he was giving us a context that what he was saying would have meaning. So he talks about murder. Well, we can look back even as they're reading straight through the Bible, he's talking about murder. Oh, you can look back in Genesis and find the first murder. You can see how that broke God's heart and it broke Adam's heart and how it did all these bad things. You're reading about don't steal. You can look back and you can find stealing, so you know what that means. He told it in the context of a story. They do this in Japan very well. Instead of the way that they do training often, they have a senpai and a kohai. And the senpai is the mentor, and the kohai is the green novice guy who doesn't know anything. And they match them together, and the senpai trains the kohai by telling him stories. So instead of being all these facts, you are 66% more likely to get hurt if you don't wear your hard hat. No, he tells him the story of that one poor fool who didn't wear a hard hat, and then the guy's like, oh, and then he wears his hard hat. And every time he takes his hard hat, he's remembering poor Johnny who didn't wear his hard hat. And he wears his hard hat. It's far more effective than being, you know what? Your brain will bleed out in 2 minutes and 38 seconds if you don't. No. It tells a story. Okay, so that's on the sticky. So back to the ladder of abstraction. Dictionaries do not give words their meanings. And this is real important, especially when you're competing over, I have Black's Law Dictionary, and it says, oh, I have William Webster's Dictionary, and it says, oh, well, I have Supreme Court, and they said,
I got Wikipedia.
I got Wikipedia. Okay? Dictionaries don't give words their meanings. Okay? The meanings existed, and so we had to attach words to them. Okay? And there are meanings that words can't hardly express. That's why we have art. That's why God, in addition to writing the Bible, he wrote an entire other Bible called the Clear Testimony of Nature. Paul talks about this, and he says the gospel is clear in the testimony of nature. You can look at a tree and be like, what can the tree teach me about the kingdom of God? What is the spiritual truth embodied in this tree? It's not that the tree is the kingdom, but it's that the tree can teach us things. And that's why Jesus was able to use such concrete examples, is because the author of the universe from the very beginning wrote those truths into nature. And then if you're looking and if you're asking the right questions, you can find the truth from nature. And that when you look at the nature and when you look at the Bible together, they explain each other. So you read the Bible and it says the Holy Spirit is like a breath. It's like wind. So then you're like, I need to learn about wind. And so you go and you study about wind, and then suddenly what you've learned about wind shows you more about the Holy Spirit. Okay? So the meanings existed, and so we attach words to those meanings. And there's different kinds of definitions. You've got extensional definitions and intentional definitions. Who can tell me what these two words mean very quickly?
Give the definition.
Okay, see, this part was not in the story, and you don't remember it, and I don't blame you, because when I had to look it up myself. Extensional means that is a table, you can point to it. An intentional meaning, something you have to describe. But more importantly, there's a difference between a connotative and a denotative definition. Okay? If I say something is a pig, I'm talking a pink animal with four legs, right? But if I say you are a pig, it has a totally different meaning. Okay? Some words, their connotative meaning speaks so loudly that their denotative meaning is lost. Okay? So the denotative meaning of, let's say, the stars and bars, that flag, the denotative meaning is a nation that existed and it believed in states' rights. But the connotative meaning of that flag is racial hatred. And my brother can quote you all sorts of things from Jefferson Davis saying the Civil War was not about slavery, blah, blah, blah. And denotatively, that might be true, but the connotative meaning of that flag is racial hatred. Does that make sense? And so you have to be careful the words you use, what they're understanding. And the key to understanding the meanings of the words is the context that they're in. Just like a note, the notes make sense in the melody given the context of the song, and the words we use make sense given the context of what we're saying. And so it's very important. That's how stories help, because they give context to what we're saying. So, very quickly, some real quick practicals. In a cross-examination, if someone defines something by going up on the ladder of abstraction, take them into the clouds. Here's an example. What do you mean by the word red? Well, it's a color up on the ladder. What's a color? Well, it's a quality that things have. What's a quality? Say, what are you trying to do anyway? Okay, a quality that things have, that could mean anything, right? Okay, another. Form a definition loop around the other team. You can do this a lot. And this is if they're trying to define a word by going on the same level of the ladder of abstraction. What do you mean by democracy? Democracy means the preservation of human rights. What do you mean by rights? By rights, I mean those privileges God grants us. I mean inherent privileges, such as liberty, for example. What do you mean by liberty? Religious and political freedom. What do you mean by religious and political freedom? Remember, you're trying to pull them down on the ladder of abstraction. Well, religious and political freedom, that's what we enjoy under a democracy. It's gone in a full circle, right? So you can use, and one of the things I found very effective in cross-examinations is pull people down and make them be more specific. Because as they're more specific, they reveal the true truth of what they're saying. You see, a politician can get up and talk for a long time without saying anything because he stays very abstract. I believe that we should improve education in the United States. And we need to do this by making sure that the classrooms teach better material and that the students learn better. And we need to have a smaller government. And by that I mean that the government needs to do more things smaller. And they say, we need to have a better economy. And everyone's like, yeah, better economy, yeah, fix the economy. And they're not saying how they're going to make the economy better. That how they're going to make the economy better is by spending more money, by taking more money out of the economy. Anyway, so, and be careful of that. Don't let the other team get away with it, and don't do it yourself, because you will bore your judge, or you'll lose the round, okay? We don't want to be boring. We want to go up and down the ladder of obstruction. A lot of judges come in, and they're so overwhelmed because they either came out of a team policy round, and they have about 800 facts and figures and quotes all swimming around in their minds, or they came out of a Lincoln Douglas round, and they have no idea what just went on. Okay? If you can tell an emotionally compelling story that can connect with the judge, they will come up with a reason to vote for you. I really mean that. You can tell a good story. They'll come up with a reason to vote for you. So in your 1ACs, write in a story. I remember when I was competing, we had a story that we told of we compared the current taxation system to a blizzard. And we talked about how this blizzard in the West, or in the East, shut down everyone for 2 days and no one got any work done because it took 2 days to clear the roads. And we said, the current IRS income taxes takes 2 days, and we had the stats to back it up, but we shared them briefly, takes 2 days per person to fill out their tax return, and that's doing devastation to our economy like a blizzard does devastation to the economy. And the judges are like, I can resonate with that. They would probably resonated with it better if we didn't give all of our speeches in Texas, but you see what I'm saying. It's telling a good story. Now, I would like to encourage you, for those of you who did not break, and then we'll break to questions, of all of my time debating, I had a 3-3 record or a winning record. How many times would y'all guess? Twice. I only had a winning record at 2 tournaments my entire life. So if you have just come back from the last tournament and you're like, oh, we went 3-3. You're already halfway there, at least to where I got. So don't be too devastated, okay? I lost a whole lot, and I learned a whole lot from that. So with that said, are there any questions? Yes.
So why you're an excellent speaker, and thank you. Why do you think it is that you lost a lot? What did you learn from it?
Why did I lose, and what did I learn? Well, one, I learned to get a haircut. I definitely lost a whole tournament's worth of rounds because I had hair down to my shoulders and I was talking about why we should grow industrial hemp. And while I had the facts, and how hemp is different than marijuana, the story that my hair was telling and the connotative meaning of the way that I presented myself was so loud that the judges just could not hear what I was saying as hard as they tried. And so I came out of pretty much every single one of those rounds. I'm like, man, I thought we won that one. And I looked at my ballots. I'm like, oh. I think I won one round as power match at the very end of the tournament because, anyway, it was bad. So that was one thing that I learned. Another thing that I learned was a lot of things that I'm presenting now. I didn't know how to tell stories. I was all about if you just get the facts, and if your facts are better, then you win. I also didn't do research very well. My first partner left me because I didn't hold up my end of the research, and she was really good, and we won a tournament together. And after she left, I didn't win any more tournaments that whole season. So it's probably the closest thing I've ever gotten to getting dumped. But I learned a very valuable lesson from that. Carry your weight when you're preparing, because even though, and it's really bad, because she put in so much more work than I did, and then I get up there and smile, this is before my hair got too long, and I get more speaker points, and she's just like, oh, this is not fair. And I only didn't get a whole lot more speaker points. So that was some of the things that I learned. And to close, I want to tell a story. Antioch in the Bible was located right in the southern border of Turkey and the northern border of Syria. The church in Antioch was known for its church planting. It sent out mission teams. It sent out Paul and Barnabas. It sent out John Mark. It sent out Paul and Silas. And that church planted churches all throughout the Roman world. Well, God allowed the lamp of the church in that place to be extinguished. And 2 decades ago, you could count the number of Christians in Turkey by the dozens. The lamp of the Spirit, the lamp of the gospel, had completely gone out. God allowed His truth to completely leave that nation. And He is allowing the lamps of Europe to also go out. If you look at what's happened in Europe over the last 100 years, the lamps there are also going out. And here in the United States, we see that sign. But God is wanting to do something in our generation. In the young generation, He's got a plan and He's stirring something up. But the enemy is fighting against Him. The enemy's got a threefold plan to stop God's purposes in this generation. And that plan is one through addictions. We can get distracted and bound to an addiction, whether it's to alcohol or drugs or video gaming. We are unable to fulfill God's purposes in our life if all we're doing, if this addiction is consuming our passions. The second thing He's trying to do to stop us is through abortion. He knows if He can kill us, we will not speak. And 1/3 of my generation has been killed. The enemy is serious. He is dead serious. The third thing that the enemy is trying to do to stop God's purposes in this nation and to allow the lamp to go out is through apathy. If He can't kill us and if He can't get us addicted, by golly, He'll get us to not care. He'll get us to stay in our churches and to keep the truth that we know to ourselves. He'll keep us out of the public square. He'll keep us out of the voting booth, and He'll keep us out from affecting a lost and dying nation that's very quickly falling to iniquity and sin. And I call and I ask you to say no to these three things. Say no to the addictions, and if you know someone's in addiction, pray for them and do what you can to bring them into freedom. Say no to abortion. Take a stand. I have here flyers. Tomorrow is the Texas Rally for Life. This is the 35th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. That's 35 years of my generation getting killed because we are doing nothing. I go to this rally often, and every time I go, I am ashamed to be a Protestant because we're just not there. The Catholics are there. They're holding the line. But Catholics only comprise 33% of this nation. If the other 60% of us would just show up, we could see a difference. If we would just vote, if we would just give, and if we would just pray, something could change. But the problem is that it's not important. You see, there's measurements of importance. And one of those is time, and one of those is money. And we've got to make standing up for those who are dying important. I'm not called to do pro-life stuff. That's not the primary calling that God has on my life. God has called me to reach out to gamers that are addicted and lost. But I cannot stand and do nothing while my generation is killed. And I ask that you do not either. We've got to take a stand. And by doing it, we will be defeating the enemy's third thing, the apathy. We can say no. You can say no. You can say no tonight. You can say, I will stand up for God's purposes in this generation. I will not allow the lamp to go out while I am still alive. Generations of Christians have died to see the lamps in their nations continue to burn. The lamp in China is beginning to burn again for the first time in 1800 years. God is doing things around the world. He wants to do things now. He wants to use us. So thank you very much. That's why we're doing what we're doing. Thank you.